Welcome to the Driving Sustainable Success in Child Welfare podcast, hosted by the Child Welfare Division of the South Carolina Department of Social Services. This is an intentional space for us to talk together, discover together, and grow together. If you have a passion for serving children and strengthening families, then you have come to the right place.
Hello, welcome to the very first episode of our Driving Sustainable Success in Child Welfare podcast, a product of the South Carolina Department of Social Services. I'm your host, Emily Madeer, the Deputy State Director of Child Welfare. For our very first episode, I really racked my brain about what it should be. I wanted it to be something that provides a frame and a foundation for all of the great topics to come. And when I was thinking about it, I thought, what better to start with than our guiding principles and standards practice model? For South Carolina DSS Child Welfare, the GPS practice model is just that. It's our guiding standard, it's our framework, it's our foundation for everything we do within child welfare. So today, we're going to dive into all things GPS. What it is, where did it come from, and what does it mean? For our very first conversation, I'm so excited to have Josie Jones joining me. Josie is a veteran leader in our Child Welfare Services Division, and she has over 17 years of experience with the agency. She currently serves as the Spartanburg County Director and has been a leader in development and implementation of the GPS practice model since 2016. She continues to be involved with the ongoing implementation of GPS, and her vision is that the model becomes our everyday practice with each other and with our families. In her career, Josie's had a lot of awesome jobs. She's been a foster care case manager, a foster care supervisor, a regional performance coach, and she was the workgroup lead for lots of different projects across this agency. She's a graduate of the 2021 South Carolina Certified Public Manager Program, and she has her BA in psychology from Lander University and an MA in counseling from Webster University. She enjoys going to church, watching Clemson Tiger football, and spending time with her family and friends, working in the community with her sorority sisters of Delta Sigma Theta, and traveling. Josie, we're so excited to have you.
Yes. Welcome me. I'm glad to be here. And I just thankful for this opportunity to actually be able to share all GPS, everything GPS is very, very exciting and rewarding to be able to do this on our very, very first podcast. So thank you. And I look forward to our conversation today.
Awesome. So Josie, before we get into talking about GPS, I want to help our audience get to know you a little bit, if that's okay.
That's okay.
Okay, perfect. So I would love to hear from you. Why don't you tell us what got you into the work of child welfare and what makes you stay?
Well, I've always enjoyed working with children and families from day one, growing up, always a Girl Scouts, working in the community. I love babysitting. And I'm a family oriented person. So me wanting to be a part of something like that is what I've always wanted to do. I've always considered myself as a leader. So as I move forward through the agency and working in different aspects of the agency, I saw myself growing and wanting to be more involved with not only people and families, but also seeing where we can go in this work. So here now, where I am now, I just get a joy out of seeing people grow. I love seeing people meet the desires of and achieve their outcomes. And most importantly, even now in Spartanburg, I tell them all the time that my desire now is to see you continue to grow in your role. And that's what I do. And that's what I love to do. And most importantly, now where I am, I love seeing transformation. I love seeing this work transform, GPS assisting with that and everything else that is to come. So that's just what gets me joy, that brings excitement to me. And I'm just really excited about everything that is coming and is to come for child welfare.
That's so good. So for you, child welfare and why you do the work or what got you into this work, it was really about family and community is what I heard you say.
Yes. Family and community. And here I am now as a leader. I just love to see that in others. So I know there's case managers that may be inspiring to be leaders one day. And I just love to see them grow into that. Leaders growing to be better leaders. So that's the joy that I get out of it now. And of course, still love seeing children and being with families. When you have a network of professionals who really love doing what we do, you want to pour into them. You want to see them grow just as much as I've grown. So that's where my joy comes in at now.
I love it. And it's really about community, small and large, right? So we have a community of DSS and we're a community within each other that fosters growth, that loves to see each other grow and succeed. but it's really about the larger community too, right. right? And that's what our families need, is they need that larger community to be able to be strengthened, to be able to accomplish the vision of what we want. Our families have to have the larger community.
That's right. That's right. And oftentimes that's what we, I believe, with our GPS model and what we're trying to show the community is we at DSS don't do this work alone. Mm. We need the community. We need the neighborhoods. We need the churches. We need law enforcement. We need the next door neighbors to come in to help us. So it's just amazing. It's an amazing feeling. And I've always enjoyed working in the community, being around children and families. And DSS is where I believe my calling is at this point. It is my career and I enjoy it.
That's so good. That's so good. So let's get right into talking about GPS practice model. Sound good?
It sounds great.
All right. So start by telling us a little bit about the origin story of GPS. So why was it needed? Like, where did the idea come from? How did it get started?
Okay. So around 2016, the agency realized that we did not have a consistent practice across the state. For example, I worked in the upstate for the past 17 years, but in the upstate, going down to the Lowcountry, the work looked totally different. Or in the PD, going to the Midlands, it looked totally different. And then, you know, over time that happens because we have administration that changes. There's different visions, there's different focuses, there's different practices, but we never had anything that was consistent on our values, what we wanted out of child welfare. So that's how it all began. 2016, there was a state leadership group that came together and said, hey, we want something better for child welfare. What could that be? And out of that, we formed a small work group and we started doing research. We looked at various practice models across our country, New York, New Hampshire, Casey Family Services, a lot of those. And we was trying to figure out, okay, what resonated with us, South Carolina? What
makes South Carolina different? Right?
Exactly. Yeah. So that's where we started. We started looking at, you know, like I said, different practice models, seeing how those states operated. We did some research on implementation science. Mm. And that was key for South Carolina because in the past, we would implement somewhere, somehow, it would fizzle off. There was no sustainability to that. So we read Jane MacArthur's research on implementation science.
Tell me a little bit more about that, Josie. So what is implementation science for maybe somebody who's never heard of that word before?
Yes. So implementation science is literally taking the time to do the research, refine what you're wanting, and literally write out a plan on how you want to implement that. It's going back, redefining, it's operationalizing that. And when I say operationalizing, that's going out and talking to people, getting them to see, hear, and feel what you're thinking, and then redefining that again. And it takes time, right? Yeah. Implementation is not 6 months, 1 year. Like this GPS, this is a multi-year transformation project.
Yeah.
And with implementation, that's what that it is. It's not something that you just stop and say, oh, we're done. You got to take your time and you got to look at it. And believe me, even through this process, we have took our time. We had to revamp. We had to start over again. And it's worth it, but it takes time. And that's one thing that we had to do. So again, in that development process, that's what we did. We vetted it over 400 case managers, supervisors, talked to youth partners. We talked to parents. We talked to our community partners. We talked to attorneys. We talked to everybody across the state. I remember driving to the PD area and vetting it across that community, again, trying to get a feel for what what our internal staff wanted, what our external partners wanted, and then figuring that out all together. Because like I stated in my earlier is, we don't do this work alone.
Yeah.
We rely on everyone. So it was a group of us, and we also collaborated with Chapin Hall, which is a consulting firm out of Chicago, Illinois, who came alongside us and said, hey, y'all got a good draft. That's what we had. We had a good draft. But,
it's a good start.
But then after that, they were able to help us redefine what that was. And so that's what that development process was. And now we have, like you said, a GPS practice model. And it is a roadmap. Yeah. It's a roadmap to how we do this work. And it doesn't stop at case managers. And I want to make sure I say that. It doesn't stop at case managers or supervisors. It is for all levels of child welfare, to the state director, to you, Emily, as our deputy director, regional directors, program managers, county directors. is for everyone. And it provides that framework, a guide to how we can truly engage not only ourselves, our colleagues, the person who's sitting next door to me, but also our children and families that we collaborate with, we work with every day.
What I hear you saying is GPS really isn't just a project or an implementation, right? It's really almost a culture shift in the way that we work with families.
You said it, culture shift. That's exactly what it is. And it's huge.
Yeah.
And I believe that the state of South Carolina, where we are now, is this is what we needed. Mm. And I know as we continue to move forward, it will continue to grow. It'll make our system better. We'll have better outcomes. We'll have stronger families and children. Within ourselves, we will be even more connected with each other. Literally, I believe the foundation to our transformation is our GPS practice model.
So let's talk a little bit about the vision and values of GPS. So I know that we have four values, right? So respect, excellence, accountability, and community invested, right?
That's right.
So I can imagine in the development phase that it was so hard to narrow it down to just four values. I can imagine that was probably a process, right?
It was.
So why these four values?
Emily, it was like you just stated, it was very hard. But when we vetted, we had six questions that we went across the state. And one of those questions were, what do you believe in children and families? What do you think we should look for when we hire into our agency? And some of the responses that we got, it helped us narrow down our we believe statements, along with identifying what our core four visions and values should be. And one of the out of the four, of course, we always talk about accountability, right?
Yeah.
And we talk about it, we live it, we always say we gotta hold somebody.
What is accountability?
But literally, you know, even with accountability, when we looked at that value, we wanted not only to hold ourselves accountable for how we engage families and how we engage our community partners, how we engage our children and families, but we felt like, you know, in order to have successful outcomes, we have to hold everyone accountable. Mm-hmm. And it's not, well, you better do this, you better do that. But it's just meeting people where they are and then letting them have a say in how they want to, you know, strengthen themselves. And so, you know, that was a one of the biggest words that a lot of people wanted to use. But then when we looked at community invested, like I shared before, DSS was the top and everybody wanted to come to DSS. But DSS was saying, there's other community partners out there. There's other people out here that could prevent before coming to our doorsteps.
Yeah.
So when you look into the We Believe statements of community invested, we literally say, you know, the community is neighborhoods, churches, the next door neighbor. We list them out, schools, hospitals, because it takes all of us, a village. Like, you know how growing up it says it takes
yes,
a village?
That's what I was just thinking about.
To raise a
yeah.
child. It takes a village to strengthen a family.
Yeah.
And that's what we looked at. But I want to say one of my favorite values is excellence.
Mm.
And if you take the time, and I'm going to say this, take the time to study and read it and learn it. One of the We Believe statements, it says, the very first one, and I remember sitting in a meeting room with our core team and said, this should be the number one We Believe statement for excellence. And it says, excellence begins with me. And the reason why I chose that, and I told them I felt like this was the very first part of that, is because when you start to engage families, when you start to engage your colleagues, you got to remove your biases.
Yeah.
Any kind of personal thoughts or feelings that you may perceive after reading something on a black and white paper,
yeah.
or any thoughts that you may perceive after receiving something from a next door neighbor or your case manager or whoever, you have to go and meet that family.
Yeah.
So before you do all of that, you have to make sure you yourself are intact. And you're removing any kind of thoughts that you may have. So I share this all the time at Spartanburg. Excellence begins with me. I cannot start a meeting without making sure myself is well taken care of. Mm. And I've removed any kind of biases that I have. As an investigation case manager, you can't go knock on that front door without removing whatever thoughts you may think about this family because of the report that you may have read.
Yeah.
And it goes on for family preservation and foster care, adoption workers, anybody, intake workers, anybody. So that is one of the biggest things for me. And, you know, when you look at the model, it says our values are our behaviors, our qualities that we look for in those that we hire, and we expect them to demonstrate those. So they're the core to everything that we do. So again, I challenge our listeners to go get this model, and we'll talk about that later, where you can find it.
Yeah.
And study it, read it, learn it for yourself, because it is the desires and the voice of everybody. We didn't create these ourselves. Mm. Our system, those that are in our system, created these visions and values.
Mm, that's really good, Josie. So I'm thinking about this idea of excellence begins with me, right? Mm-hmm. And so I'm trying to connect the dots in my mind. And what it takes me back to is this idea of accountability, right? Because accountability begins with me too.
That's right.
Right? I can't hold anybody else accountable if I'm not taking care of my own stuff.
That's right.
And so I think that, you know, excellence begins with me is almost like, for me, almost seems like an overarching value that encompasses the other ones too, right? Because if we're doing excellent practice, if we're being excellent in everything that we do, we are holding ourselves accountable to do what we say we're going to do. We are making sure that the family comes first. You know, some of our guiding principles that we'll talk about in a minute. We're respecting others, right?
Yes.
Like you said, we're removing those biases. We're respecting others. We're meeting families where they're at. And then we're making sure that the community is empowered to wrap around those families
to become
that village. So let me talk about a little bit about the guiding principles. So I kind of segued into one of them, right? I'm going to ask you a little bit more about the guiding principles. So what does it mean to have a guiding principle as a system? So if we're talking about like child welfare as a system, our communities as a system, what does it mean to have a guiding principle? And what are ours?
Right. So the guiding principles for us are our fundamental truths that serve as our foundation to guide our everyday practice, behaviors, relationships, interactions with our clients and our colleagues. So it is what we do. Literally, you're getting ready to put the pen to the paper, so to speak. So we have four. We have four guiding principles, and those are family-centered, trauma-informed, culturally responsive, and individualized and strength-based. So again, looking at all of those four and how did we come up with them? What resonated for us?
Yeah.
One thing, like I shared before, we wanted to shift. It wanted to be more family focused, family centered. We knew that's where we needed to go. And for us in South Carolina, that was new for us. That's very new. Mm-hmm. I mean, as a case manager years ago, completing a child and family team meeting, that wasn't even something that we thought about. I mean, if we did it amongst ourselves, right? Yeah. And you know, we wanted to look at that and say, what can we do differently? How can we, again, meet the family where they are versus sitting at our own desk and completing their own treatment plans for them?
That's a good point. What does it look like to be family-centered in practice? Like, how does that actually look?
So it looks really good. I'll tell you that now. So our listeners, it looks really good. And I'm going to give you an example because an example to me is going to help resonate when I say this. But one of the very first implementation activities that we did to be more family-centered was our child and family team meetings.
Okay. So what are child and family team meetings?
So child and family team meetings are where we come together, we meet, we invite our parents, we invite the age-appropriate youth, we invite community partners that's connected to the parents. We invite the parent support systems. So that can be the aunt, the cousin, the grandmother, next door neighbor, the pastor.
Yeah.
We invite any kind of anybody that the family feels is a great support to them. Almost like I said, the village.
Yeah.
That's who's coming together, the village. And what we're doing is giving the youth and the parent the voice. That's new DSS.
Tell me a little bit more about that, Jesse.
That's new DSS. Okay. We're giving them the voice. We're allowing them to tell us, what is it that they need to help them to become better? That's just what it is. And that is new. That is the new DSS. We did some of that, but also would come to the table and say, this is what you're going to do. And we didn't want to do that anymore because it wasn't sustainable.
So and it's not what's best for the family
best.
Either, right?
It's not best. So that is being family centered. Or again, you walking down the hallway. We're walking down the hallway and engaging our own colleagues. Stop and asking them, how are you doing today? you know, getting to know them, understanding who they are and how to better build those relationships with your next door neighbor, person who sits next door to you.
Yeah.
And that is being family centered, you know, and not taking it for just who it is and say, okay, I'm at work today. You know, we want to make it welcoming, because guess what? We come to work. We're probably at work more days with each other than we are with our families at times.
That's so true.
So we just trying to build a better culture so that everybody, our children, our families, our community partners, along with ourselves, our colleagues, feel that this is a better culture altogether. We are working together. We're building relationships. We're meeting families where they are. And ultimately, we're having better outcomes.
Yeah.
That's what we wanted to do.
Because the families are the ones in the driver's seat, driving what their needs are, right?
That's
what
right.
They think that will help accomplish whatever they see as their need. And we're just there to partner alongside them just to be their support system.
That's
so
right.
To come along and be part of their village.
That's right.
That's
I like
good.
That word, village.
Yeah, that's such a great concept. So let's talk a little bit more about trauma-informed. So I heard you say trauma-informed is one of our guiding principles. So when I think about trauma-informed, you know, I've heard this described before in the past as almost like a reframing of your mind, right? So why did or didn't you do something to what happened to you, right? Mm-hmm. What happened to lead to this situation? So have you heard something similar like that? And maybe tell me a little bit more about what trauma-informed means, both for us in child welfare mm-hmm. and then for our system too.
Yeah. So I've heard that. And again, when we looked at being more trauma-informed, we knew we needed that in our GPS practice model. We know that is something that we need within our system. And over time, we lost that. The work that we do, it affects everyone. Mm-hmm. Some way, somehow, our families are already traumatized through their own experiences. We as the professionals, we become traumatized, secondary trauma,
yeah.
because of dealing with it and then trying to, you know, work through whatever we may be dealing with. One thing that I've noticed across, you know, in where I work and just with some of the engagements that I've had, I believe we're moving there.
Mm-hmm.
I believe we are recognizing when others are not at their best.
Yeah.
We are recognizing when families are not at their best.
Mm-hmm.
And when we recognize that, that makes us better. One thing that I see even within our system as a whole, we're even bringing out more of our employee assistance program, right? We're talking more about, you know, how you could take care of yourself.
Yeah.
How you could take care of yourself in knowing that you may have just dealt with a child fatality last week, you know, or, you know, how you deal with just the day-to-day interactions that you may have because a client is fussing it at you or cussing at you. It can wear you down. So being trauma informed is just recognizing where you are in that space. Not only you as the employee or the professional, but even recognizing the families where they are in that space, and then taking time to pause. So like a good example in Spartanburg, we were on a child and family team meet, and a child really was affected by some of the things that are being said. And you can see the family kind of getting that way. And the facilitator paused and told everyone, we're going to take a break. And that's recognizing, again, that this space right now is getting a little cloudy. And in order for us to be productive and reaching the ultimate goal of a child and family team meeting, we need to take a break from that. And that's what they did. They took a break and then they reconvened and was able to move forward. But that's just what trauma-informed is. Mm-hmm. You have to recognize it. You can't shut it off. But being able to recognize it, and then once you recognize it, put matters in place to help strengthen that family, strengthen that professional, strengthen whoever it is, even yourself, so that you can be better when you work through all of that.
Yeah. So trauma-informed is really about recognizing the humanity, right?
Oh, yes.
For ourselves as workers, as people who work in child welfare, and for our families. And then having that compassion and empathy to recognize that what we may see right in front of us may not be the whole story, right?
That's right.
So I want to talk a little bit about what it looks like to be trauma-informed with our young people, right? So we have about 30% of the people, children and youth that are in custody in South Carolina that are teenage age, right?
Teenage.
Right.
Yes.
And so I was on, you know, I'll share, I was on a training earlier this week, and they asked people to talk about when they hear the word teenager, right? And so you can imagine, Josie, you can imagine all the words that, and the adjectives that came up, but things, people were saying things like stinky, right? Back talking, attitude, right? And so I was sitting here thinking about these words that come mm-hmm. to mind when we say teenager, right? And that's not me knowing the teenager. That's me just associating the word teenager. I thought about how does that show up in the work that we do and how we relate to our young people? And what, how does trauma, being trauma informed, being excellence driven, how does that come into play with how we interact with our young people, right? And how we recognize the trauma that they have most definitely experienced if they are in contact or inside our system or our custody. Talk to me about that.
So, Emily, I'm glad you brought that up, because I think our listeners are also realizing that we're shifted a lot and have dealt with a lot of more teenagers in our system. And of course, like you just said, when you first think about it, these type of adjectives and things that are descriptions of the word teenagers. Mm-hmm. But in our work, our teenagers have gone through all kind of different experiences. Mm-hmm. So as a professional, the thing you have to think about is one, stepping back, right? Mm. And again, taking the pause and the whatever biases that you may perceive out and looking at the teenager for who he or she is and recognizing that, okay, this youth may have gone through X, Y, and Z, but how can I meet this youth where he or she is now and help them move past X, Y, and Z.
Yeah.
And oftentimes we have to have harsh conversations about that, because we the first thing we want to say is, oh, these are behavior issues and all these other things.
We like to point to behaviors
right,
a lot.
Right, yeah. right. And oftentimes those behaviors are because of something else, right? They've experienced something else. I always tell my staff in Spartanburg, you have to peel away the onion.
That's such
a good
analogy.
And when peeling away the onion, you get down to the core of what is really driving this teenager or this youth to respond in the way that they're responding. And that's what being trauma informed about is, when you're connecting with teenagers. and there are different type of population. We can work with them just like we work with our 0 to 5 year olds and everybody else.
Absolutely.
It could be a little challenging, but it's doable. And it's doable if you come with the right mindset, coming with the right mindset to the table that we're here to help. We're here to connect them to the appropriate services where they should be. But also recognizing that this youth didn't wake up one day and said, I'm going to do this and this is my life.
Yeah.
This youth probably was put in an unfamiliar situation and was not expecting it to be the way it came out. And then after that, got succumbed to other things that they were faced with, controlled or not controlled. Either way it goes, they went through that experience. And now we as the agency have to help them and the community help them to overcome their experiences.
And our community, so what I'm thinking is our community is our foster parents too, right? So, you know, you mentioned sometimes, you know, teenagers maybe a little more difficult to connect with than like our 0 to 5 year olds, right? But they want that compassion and that love and that stability just as much of any of our kids in the system.
Yes.
Right. And having that committed foster parent or that committed support system, that committed relationship that really helps them make that connection to permanency and help connect to their why and take the time to peel back the onion.
Right.
Get at the core. That can be so meaningful for our young people.
It can. And I'll give a little story. Thinking about a youth that we're managing now, 16-year-old youth is going through a whole lot. We've connected her to the community. We've connected her to her own job. She has a job. She's excited about the job, back into school and getting into some athletic activities. And, you know, when you see her now compared to when she first came to us, it's a different youth. But it's because, again, harsh conversations at times, which is okay. Looking back, peeling back that onion again and looking at where this youth came from and listening to her, because she had a voice.
Yeah.
She told us
what
her desires were, where she wanted to be, what she wanted to do. Great professionals rallied around that and started plucking out those that we felt like that was going to help foster her desires.
That's so good. So that, you know, I feel like that scenario that you just gave, that touched on all the guiding principles, right?
Yeah. Yes.
That was being trauma informed. That was taking the pause to peel back the onion, mm-hmm. to learn why. It was being individualized and strength-based, like really listening to that youth's voice and listening to what she wanted, right? And had a better outcome because of it. That's awesome.
Yes. And I would say, you know, in our practice model, the framework, when you get to the guiding principles and you read about it, we actually give examples. We operationalize this, the guiding principles, all four of them. We give examples of what that looks like for a case manager, what it looks like for a supervisor, and what it looks like for a manager.
Wow.
And from there, we show how you operationalize it with client and how you do it with your colleague. So again, I'm going to tell you again, get to the book framework. It's like our Bible. It's our Bible for child welfare, because it gives you the tools to help you as a professional grow in this work. But it also helps you when trying to engage and be a better person for yourself.
That is so much great stuff about the guiding principles. So I want to talk a little bit about our core practice skills. So can you tell me what are core practice skills, and what does it mean to have core practice skills or to use core practice skills with our family?
So these are the skills that we determined that case managers would need to practice every day. The goal was to move from agency compliant to more family-centered, family-focused type practice. So those six, we had six of them, and believe me, there were a lot. I remember sitting in a room with our core group and just writing down different skills that we know that we use in our everyday work. But we identified six, and those six were engaging, teaming, assessing, planning, intervening, and tracking and adapting. The core practice skills are the how-to in every practice that we do. So we developed practice profiles. And of course, with these practice profiles, we have them for case managers and we have them for supervisors, and we developed eight of them. So in these practice profiles, it provides literally word by word, using our guiding principles, using our core practice skills, and using our values on how to do X, Y, and Z. For example, documentation. It literally tells the case manager how to plan for a documentation before a visit, how to plan for completing the documentation during the visit, and then what you should do after the visit. For supervisors, we have a practice profile for supervision. And in that, it helps the supervisor prepare for his or her one-on-one interaction with that case manager. So there's a section where the supervisor literally can go read, how do I need to prepare for my one-on-one case consultation or my one-on-one just meeting with my case manager? What do I need to focus on while I'm in that meeting? Mm-hmm. And then how do I end that meeting? After the meeting, what should I do as a supervisor? So we have different ways to help case managers, supervisors, managers on how to improve and work through their core practice skills by utilizing the practice profiles.
Your practice profile is almost like your how-to guide that brings everything together, it sounds like, right? So it has the values, it has the guiding principles, it has the core practice skills, and it literally brings it all together and says, this is what you do with it.
When you look at it, again, trying to identify the eight, like how could we identify the eight? Because we're doing a lot of work, right? Yeah. We're trying to do so much, and it's great. But even one of them is child-parent contact. And we all know we're trying to improve how we engage our parents, how we document those contacts, what that contact should look like, right? When you're engaging that kid or that parent, what that should look like. If you go to the practice profiles, it even shows you, it gives you questions what to ask. Mm-hmm. And you're using your core practice skills, engaging. Engagement is the skill, but you're using that. Planning. How do you plan with that parent? Completing those case planning, doing affirmancy plans. How do you do that? It lays it all out. It's almost like a textbook quiz. You have it in front of you. Nice. You just have to utilize it. That's what we've tried to do. We felt like, you know, to shift a massive system, right? We had to make it easy, somewhat easy for our professionals.
Yeah.
And we felt like by having the framework, which is one thing, is the booklet. But then the practice profiles that a case manager or a supervisor, director, manager can take with them to help prepare for that engagement that you're going to have or prepare for that functional assessment that you're going to do. It literally is the how-to. All you have to do is open it and read it.
So if I'm a case manager and let's say I print out my practice profiles, right? I have them in a folder. I keep them with me everywhere. Like it'll take me what? Like 30 seconds, a minute to read through my practice profile. So if I want to just like, again, that pause, right? That pause that we're talking about. How do we be excellence driven? How do we take a breath? So if I want to be excellence driven, I could pull out my folder before I'm getting ready to do a parent-child contact, scan over it and just center myself on this is how I bring GPS into act.
Yes, exactly. And when they do that, they see, you're going to see your values come out. You're going to see your guiding principles because we were intentional about linking those back to whatever they were reading. So they, again, could connect the dots, connecting the dots and bringing GPS to life in the field, in your offices, to change our system in your community, to change our culture, everything.
Wow, that's so good. So I want to dig a little bit more into some of the core practice skills. So talk to me about what does it mean to do a functional assessment? That sounds like a really technical term, right? So what does that even mean?
So yes. So again, we're assessing all the time. We're doing informal assessments. We're doing formal assessments. And of course, our formal assessment is taking like our newly adopted FAST or taking that assessment and meeting that family where they are and rating them, right? That you're rating on what you're seeing, what you're hearing, what you're being told, and taking that assessment and connecting them to the correct service. That's what you're doing. And that's what a functional assessment is. And informal is literally, you may not have a document.
Yeah.
But you may just be, again, talking to somebody, sitting there, listening, back gathering, and then connecting them to wherever they need to be. You know, we use all the fancy words a lot, right?
But yeah,
if you want to make it simple, it's just literally listening and then connecting.
That's so good.
Connecting them to where they need to be. And again, going back to meeting them where they are and not us saying, oh, thank you for telling me this is what you need to do. It's a conversation. Well, we're like us today. Yeah. It's a conversation and trying to know that client or that person next to you and then assisting them with whatever they need.
So they all feed into each other, right?
They do.
So what I'm hearing is like an informal assessment is really just listening and taking in all of the information around you, right?
To make
determinations, to make decisions. And then the functional assessment is really just a tool to support your informal assessment.
That's
so it's where everything that's in your head goes onto the paper, onto the tool, and then helps you really support your decision making and make the decision about what the next steps are, again, with the family at the table.
That's right.
That's good. So talk to me a little bit about tracking and adapting.
I'm so glad you brought that one up. And I'm going to tell you why. So again, trying to, of course, implement GPS, not only across the state, but even in my own county. And listening to some of the trainings and things that we're doing, which, again, is incorporating GPS, there are some that don't understand tracking and adapting. And they're like, I don't track and adapt. But guess what? You do that every day. We're constantly looking at how we are engaging our clients or our children. We're constantly tracking, you know, their services, how well they're doing in their services. We're constantly adapting to what we're hearing on how they're doing in their services and then connecting them to something else. We're always tracking and adapting. We're looking at our data reports every day, you know, looking at how well we are thriving and improving in our practice overall. And if we're not, we're adapting to that, right? We're making changes every day to figure out how we can improve. So tracking and adapting is not always, you know, looking at data. It's also checking in with the family, talking with the family, seeing where they are, and then connecting them to other things. For example, if you have a family who was, you know, sent over to substance abuse counseling, right? And, you know, they get in that and you realize you're monitoring their services and they're telling you, hey, Emily, this is not going to work for me. So as a case manager, what you're going to do is you're going to listen and then you're going to start looking for other services that's going to help this client. You're monitoring where they are now, but now you're adapting and changing to something else because that's going to help them thrive and be better. So I always just tell everyone when I talk to them, we're always tracking and adapting. It's not just sitting at a board or spreadsheet and doing all that other stuff. We're constantly looking at our family primacy plans. We're always reevaluating our CANS assessments and our FAST assessments. We're always tracking. Mm-hmm. We do that. We do it and you don't even know that you're doing it. Because again, fancy word, tracking and adapting, huh? You're doing it. You're just doing it in a different way.
So tracking is more like, or is, monitoring or observing what's going on, right? Whether it's my own behavior, whether it's a family's behavior, whether it's how things are looking on my data, because you brought up data. And then adapting is just changing your behavior to get the outcome you want.
Yep.
Okay, cool. Yep. Okay, so that makes it pretty simple then.
It is. It's very simple.
And it's kind of like a continuous quality improvement process, right?
Yes.
So it's about continually looking at things and changing it up to get the outcome that we want.
Yes.
So does that mean, Josie, that I don't have to get things right the first time?
Oh, of course. Of course. Of course. And that's in our own personal lives, right? Yes. We don't get things right the first time.
Absolutely.
I know I don't either. We're always changing. We're evaluating. We're assessing. Yeah. We're tracking. And then we end up come up with something better and different, possibly. And that's the same thing with our families.
Yeah.
Same thing with our colleagues. Mm. We're always doing it. You just don't realize it. And of course, on Black and White, you see a different language, right? But when you break it down, talk about it, it's the same thing. And a lot of people now are probably saying, well, I hear about GPS. I really don't know if I'm doing it, but we're doing it. You just don't realize it. And yeah, there are things that we may have to continue to work on. But if you're calling a family and finding out more about who they are, right? Mm-hmm. Or if you're at a home and you see a statue at this family's home and you want to know more about that family and that statue, you're being culturally responsive.
Mm.
I mean, and you don't even know it because it doesn't say culturally responsive, but you're doing it. So, you know, I always try to tell even the staff in Spartanburg that guiding principles and standards practice model is a lot, right? There's a lot of Black and White in the booklet. There's a lot of Black and White in the practice profiles. It's some good, rich information that can help us improve. But if you take a step back and just think about your interactions with your colleagues, your interactions with your families, you'll probably say, oh, I am being family centered. Oh, I am using my skills of teaming. Or I am being respectful and meeting families where they are. Or I am, excellence begins with me. You know, and that's what we want our listeners. We want our field, our workforce. We want everybody to know that even though GPS is guiding principles and standards practice model, and there's all kind of booklets and things that can help, it is your everyday interactions that you have with children and families. And little do you know it, you're probably doing it right while I'm talking to you now.
Yeah.
You're probably doing it.
So it's just making those connections, the behaviors that we're doing, right? And then tracking and adapting to see where we can fit in more. That's awesome.
Yes.
That's so good, Josie. So this has been such an amazing conversation. I feel like I've learned so much and just have a better understanding of GPS as a whole. So I want to do a little summary, right?
Okay.
So we've talked about a lot. We've dug deep into different pieces of GPS. But share with me in one sentence, if you can, this might be a little challenging. Share with me in one sentence, why is the GPS practice model important to our goal of transforming the way that we work with families?
One sentence.
If you can.
One sentence. And I can. So like I've shared in the summary, you know, GPS is our roadmap to doing the work the right way. That's what it is. And if we do the work the right way, we will have better outcomes. We have stronger families, a better system, and a better culture.
I love it. Thank you so much, Josie. This has been so good. It's been such a good conversation. I've had fun and learned something at the same time. So that's always good. So where should our listeners go if they want to learn more about the Guiding Principles and Standards Practice Model?
For our listeners that are not part of the system, right, that's not internal professionals, you can go to our DSS website. And under our Child Welfare Services link, you will see a link that leads you to our practice model.
Great.
And on that, you will see a one-page document that kind of just highlights the four values, the four guiding principles, and the six core practice skills. And then there's a link to the booklet itself, about 30-something pages or so. For our internal staff, you can go to our SharePoint site And on that SharePoint site under divisions, you will see Child Welfare Services there. And once you click on that, you will see multiple boxes. And these boxes are, of course, the projects and the practices that we're working on and trying to transform. But there is a box that says GPS practice model. If you click on that, you will get to a big screen of our state director, Director Leach, doing a video launching our practice model. And to the right of that is about 6 or 7 documents. And you will find our user guide. You will find our practice model. You will find our practice profiles. You will find one pagers. And then the last thing, also, if you go to our policies, our child welfare policies, in chapter 1 under administration, you will see the user guide to our GPS practice model. And that was created and developed by one of our work groups within our GPS implementation team. So there, again, you have it. It will lay it all out for you. A quick glance at our GPS in our policy.
Awesome. So I heard you say 3 ways that we can get more information. So let me check me if I'm not getting them. So one, if you're inside DSS, so if you are a DSS professional, you can look in our policies. Mm-hmm. You can look on Unite under Child Welfare Services GPS practice model. And then if you're a partner or you're a community member or you're just a listener and you happen across our podcast and want to learn more, then you can go to our website at www.dss.sc.gov. Click on Child Welfare, and then you'll find our GPS practice model there.
That's right.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much, Josie, for your time. Thank you for sharing your expertise, for sharing your wisdom, for sharing the background. It's been so great to dig into more GPS with you.
Thank you, Emily.
And thank you to all of our listeners for joining us for the very first episode of the Driving Sustainable Success in Child Welfare podcast. If you liked what you heard, please like, follow, and subscribe to our show. We're going to have tons of great content and dig more into topics just like we did today. And until next time, I'm your host, Emily Madier. And remember, you are valued, you are important, and you are making a difference.
Thank you for joining us for the Driving Sustainable Success in Child Welfare podcast, hosted by the South Carolina Department of Social Services. If you liked what you heard, please follow and subscribe to the show. And until next time, remember, policies, mandates, and regulations will come and go. But successful, sustainable change is the result of thoughtful and passionate people collectively striving daily to improve the experiences and outcomes for all.